This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interests of its audiences in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Hello, and welcome to the African American Experience, a program celebrating the artistic, cultural, and historic contributions of African Americans. This program has been created and produced by Audio Journal's Roy Allen Project to carry on the work and vision of its namesake. Roy Allen was an extraordinary human being who deeply touched the lives of his family, his friends, and his colleagues. He was a trailblazer for African Americans in the fields of theater, radio, and television. In carrying on Roy's vision to inspire the African American community to a sense of pride and power in its achievements and to share those achievements with all the community, we present the African American Experience with your host, Tina E. Gaffney. Hello, everyone. Today, we will be talking about an artist that not a lot of people know about, Clementine Hunter. She was a self-taught African-American folk artist from the Cane River region of Louisiana who lived and worked on the Melrose Plantation. She was born near Clothierville, Louisiana, U.S., in either December of 1886 or January of 1887. She passed on New Year's Day, January the 1st, at the age of 100 years young in Natchitoches Parish, Louisiana, United States. She was an artist. Her career spanned from 1940 through 1980, and she was known for paintings of African-American Southern life. Hunter was born into a Louisiana Creole family at Hidden Hill Plantation near Clothierville in Natchitoches Parish, Louisiana. She started working as a farm laborer when she was young and never learned to read or write. In her 50s, she began to sell her paintings, which soon gained local and national attention for their complexity in depicting African-American Southern life in the early 20th century. Initially, she sold her first paintings for as little as 25 cents, but by the end of her life, her work was being exhibited in museums and sold by dealers for thousands of dollars. She produced an estimated 5,000 to 10,000 paintings in her lifetime. Hunter was granted an honorary Doctorate of Fine Arts degree by Northwestern State University of Louisiana in 1986, and she was the first African-American artist to have a solo exhibition at the New Orleans Museum of Art. In 2013, director Robert Wilson presented a new opera about her entitled Zinnias, The Life of Clementine Hunter, at Montclair State University in New Jersey. Clementine Hunter's exact birth date is unknown. She was born in late December 1886 or early January 1887 at Hidden Hill Plantation near Cloutierville in Natchitoches Parish, Louisiana. And after she was born in Natchitoches Parish in Louisiana, she turned out to be the first of seven children, born to Janvier, John Rubin, and Mary Antoinette Adams. Now, Hunter's siblings were named Maria, Ida, Rosa, Edward, Simon, and John. Hunter's maternal grandmother, Idoli, an enslaved African-American and Native American woman, was born in Virginia and brought to Louisiana. Her maternal grandfather was called Billy Zach Adams. Hunter's paternal grandfather, who was of mixed African, French, and Irish descent, traded horses during the Civil War. He passed before she was born. Hunter knew her paternal grandfather was an African-American and Native American woman, that's her grandmother, who she decided to call Maymay. Her parents were married on October the 15th, 1890, in Cloutierville at the town's Catholic church, St. John the Baptist. Hunter was baptized a Catholic on March 19th, 1887, in Cloutierville, at about 3 months old. She was baptized Clementium, went by the name Clemence for the first part of her life, and changed her name to Clementine after moving to Melrose Plantation. Her family called her by the nickname Bébé, the French for little baby, a nickname she carried into her adulthood. Hunter moved to Clothierville when she was around 5 years old, and she was sent to St. John the Baptist Catholic Church School. The school was segregated and enforced harsh rules, which Hunter cited as the reason she left school at a young age. She attended school for less than a year and never learned to read or write. Hunter began working in the fields at 8 years of age, picking cotton alongside her father. Throughout her early life, her family moved around in the Cane River Valley while her father looked for work. At certain points, they lived in Robeline, Cyprus, and Alexandria. In 1902, when Hunter was around the age of 15, her family moved to Melrose Plantation, where her father had been hired as a wage laborer by John H. Henry, the plantation owner. She worked there as an agricultural laborer as well, tolling 6 days a week for most of the year. She would pick 150 to 200 pounds of cotton a day for 75 cents in wages. In the fall, she would harvest pecans. While in her teens, Hunter took informal classes at night with other workers at Melrose Plantation. Her mother passed away in 1905 at Melrose. When Hunter was about 20 years of age, in 1907, she gave birth to her first child, Joseph Dupree, called Frenchie. Hunter's first partner was Charles Dupree, a Creole man about 15 years older than she was. Known for highly skilled labor, Charles was said to have built a steam engine with only a picture for reference. Their second child, Cora, was born a few years later, and a few years after that, Charles Dupree and Clementine Hunter never married, and Dupree passed away in 1914. 10 years after that, in 1924, Clementine married Emmanuel Hunter, a Creole employee, as a woodchopper in Melrose, who was 6 years older than her. Until her marriage, she spoke only Creole French, and she credited Emmanuel with teaching her American English. The two lived together in a worker's cabin at Melrose Plantation and had 5 children, 2 of whom were stillborn. Hunter's children were named Agnes, King, and Mary. On the morning before giving birth to one of her children, she harvested 78 pounds of cotton before going home and calling for the midwife. She was back working a few days later. In the late 1920s, Hunter began working as a cook and a housekeeper for Cammie Henry, the wife of John H. Henry. Hunter was known for her talents at adapting traditional Creole recipes, sewing intricate clothes and dolls, and tending to the house's vegetable garden. During this period, Melrose evolved into a salon for artists and writers hosted by Cammie Henry. Using discarded tubes from the visiting artists, Clementine Hunter began to paint in the late 1930s. In the late 1940s, the earlier part of the 1940s, Hunter's husband Emmanuel became terminally ill and bedridden. She became the sole financial provider for the family, working full-time while caring for Emmanuel and painting late at night. Emmanuel passed away in 1944, leaving Hunter to work and care for her children alone. During this period, in the early 1940s, Hunter adopted Mary Frances LeCour, an 11-year-old girl whose parents could no longer care for her. Hunter taught the girl how to paint and displayed her creations outside of Hunter's home. In her teens, Mary Frances moved to California to live with her father. In 1951, Mary Frances passed away at less than 20 years old. Hunter has become one of the most well-known self-taught artists. Hunter is described as a memory painter because she documented African-American Southern life in the Cane River Valley in the early 20th century. She was entirely self-taught and received almost no formal education, art or otherwise. Although she was first recognized for her painting skills in 1939, Hunter related that she had been painting long before then. Her most famous work features brightly colored depictions of important events like funerals, baptisms, and weddings, as well as scenes of plantation labor and domestic chores. However, Hunter's paintings vary in subject and style, including abstracts and still lifes. Hunter painted from memory, stating, quote, "I just get it in my mind, and I just go ahead and paint, but I can't look at nothing and paint. No trees, no nothing. I just make my own tree in my mind. That's the way I paint." Cammie Henry created an artist's colony at Melrose Plantation after the passing of her husband. Numerous artists and writers visited, including Lyle Saxon, Rourke Bradford, Alexander Wolcott, Rose Franklin, Gwen Bristow, and Richard Avedon. The paint and brushes left behind by New Orleans artist Alberta Kinsey are frequently cited as the first materials Hunter used to paint with on a window shade. However, Hunter was already producing narrative and expressionist work in textiles, including intricately detailed quilts. Additionally, Hunter's own accounts of her early career contradict the story of Kinsey's influence, with references to paintings she made earlier than 1939. Hunter began selling paintings after the passing of her husband, Emmanuel Hunter. On the outside of the cabin where she lived was a sign that read, "Clementine Hunter, Artist, 25 cents to look." Her paintings were displayed in the local drugstore, where they were sold for $1. Hunter's first shows were in 1945 in Rosenwald, Grant, Brownwood, and Waco, Texas. In 1949, an exhibit of her paintings at the New Orleans Arts and Crafts Show garnered attention outside of the Cane River Valley. An article was published about Hunter in Book Magazine in June of 1953, giving her national exposure. Hunter gained support from numerous individuals associated with Melrose Plantation, including Francois Mignon, who supplied her with paint and materials and promoted her artwork widely. In 1956, Hunter and Mignon co-authored Melrose Plantation Cookbook, featuring photographs of Melrose Plantation, illustrations drawn by Hunter, and recipes. Hunter was skilled at reinterpreting traditional dishes which had been orally passed down in her family. Hunter's largest work is a series of murals in the African house at Melrose Plantation, built in the early 19th century by enslaved people at Melrose Plantation. The African house is a Creole hybridization of various African, French, and Native American building traditions. During Cami Henry's ownership, this building served as a residence for artists. In 1949, Clementine Hunter's first show in the Cane River Valley was hosted by Mignon in the upstairs area of the African House. Hunter painted murals in the Yucca House and the main Melrose Plantation House. In 1955, Hunter and Mignon collaborated to produce the series of paneled murals that depict the history of the Cane River Valley and reflect the artist's life. The mural consists of 9 rectangular panels, each painted in Hunter's home studio. Completed over 3 months, the murals were finished when Hunter was 68 years of age. Hunter's paintings changed throughout her lifetime. Her early work, such as Cane River Baptism from 1950, featured more earth tones and muted colors. At the start of her career, Hunter used paint left by visiting artists at Melrose Plantation. Therefore, she was working with other artists' palettes. Additionally, Hunter would frequently thin out her supply of paint with turpentine, creating more of a watercolor effect, which caused many scholars to mistakenly believe she had a watercolor experimental phase. With more access to painting supplies later in her career, Hunter used a wider array of colors. Beginning in the 1950s, her painting style was altered by arthritis in her hands. Now, from this period on, she leaned more towards abstract and impressionist work with less fine detail because it was difficult for her to paint. In 1962, her friend James Pipes Register encouraged her to become even more abstract, resulting in works like Clementine Makes a Quilt. After she completed Clementine Makes a Quilt, by 1964, Hunter returned to a more narrative style. In the 1980s, as she approached 100 years old, she began painting on smaller, handheld objects, like jugs and bottles. In late 1971, 60 of Hunter's paintings were shown at an exhibition at Louisiana State University. Hunter grew up in communities of African-American sharecroppers and tenant farmers, where she learned sewing, quilting, lace-making, and basket-weaving. Francois Mignon recognized Hunter's talents with fabrics before he saw any of her painted works. On December the 19th,
1939, Mignon recorded in his journals that Hunter first showed him dolls she created with embroidered features. Additionally, he wrote that she was exceptionally talented at making fringe and knew how to spin cotton. James Register also recorded Hunter's exceptional skill at making fringe in a 1972 article in the Natchitoches Times. Hunter's quilts and tapestries feature subjects and color palettes that would later reappear in her paintings. Many of her quilts depict buildings on the Melrose grounds. Melrose Plantation Textile, 1938-1939, which is hand appliqued and sewn, is thematically similar to her painted works. Hunter's quilts are usually not batted, which signals that they were designed to hang as a tapestry rather than to serve as a household function. Most of Hunter's textile work is owned by private collections. However, a photograph of Hunter in her home shows her using one of her chevron quilts as a couch covering. Hunter made several quilts that are more abstract in style. One chevron quilt from 1951 is at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Some of the squares of chevron are alternating solid colors, while other squares are constructed with scraps of patterned cloth. Although Hunter's abstract paintings made in 1962 and 1963 are generally regarded as a break in her canon, her earlier textile work clearly plays with abstraction and impressionism. A director of the Museum of American Folklore, New York City, described Hunter as, quote, the most celebrated of all Southern contemporary painters, end quote. In 1955, Hunter was the first African-American artist to have a solo exhibition at the Delgado Museum, now the New Orleans Museum of Art. In February of 1985, the museum hosted a New Orleans salute to Clementine Hunter's centennial, an exhibit in honor of her 100th birthday. She achieved significant recognition during her lifetime, including an invitation to the White House from U.S. President Jimmy Carter and letters from both President Ronald Reagan and U.S. Senator J. Bennett Johnston, Jr. Radcliffe College included Hunter in its Black Women Oral History Project, published in 1980. An interview with Hunter is part of the Black Women Oral History Project records from 1976 through 1997, housed at Harvard University, Radcliffe Institute, the Schlesinger Library, in the Mildred H. Bailey Collection of Interviews at Northwestern State University of Louisiana. There are digitized interviews with Hunter and those closest to her. Northwestern State University of Louisiana granted her an honorary Doctor of Fine Arts degree in 1986. The following year, Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards designated her as an honorary colonel, a state honor, and aide-de-camp. A biography, Clementine Hunter, Cane River Artist, in 2012, was co-written by Tom Whitehead, a retired journalism professor who knew Hunter well. Hunter has been the subject of biographies and artist studies and inspired other works of art. In 2013, composer Robert Wilson presented a new opera about her, Zinnias, The Life of Clementine Hunter, at Montclair State University in New Jersey. Chinnery Jackson's one-woman show, musical Ain't I a Woman, honors the lives of four influential African-American women, including Hunter. Hunter's work can be found in numerous museums, such as the Dallas Museum of Fine Art, the American Folk Art Museum, Minneapolis Institute of Arts, the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, the New Orleans Museum of Art, and the Louisiana State Museum. Clementine Hunter's World is a 2017 documentary directed by noted Hunter scholar Art Shiver. The film celebrates Hunter's life and artwork through the lens of photographs, oral histories, and the newly restored African House murals. In addition to the film, the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture created an exhibition centering on Hunter called Clementine Hunter, Life on Melrose Plantation. According to Smithsonian American Art Curator Talisa Fleming, the 22 works by Hunter is the largest collection by a single artist at the museum. In 2019, Louisiana state legislators passed a resolution that designated October 1st as Clementine Hunter Day. Meletta Jones Winder, the director of the Creole Heritage Center at Northwestern State University of Louisiana, created the resolution to honor Hunter's legacy and impact on the state of Louisiana. As Hunter became increasingly more famous over her lifetime and began selling her painted works for more money, forged paintings started becoming a problem. Relatives of Clementine Hunter and Cammie Henry created forgeries, although very few. Although there were many Hunter fakes, William and Beryl Toy were the most prolific. In 1974, William J. Toy was charged with forging 22 Hunter paintings by the New Orleans police. Toy was able to pass these paintings off as Hunter originals because he recreated her distinctive signature of backward C and H interlocking. William Toy's wife Beryl claimed that she purchased the paintings directly from Hunter at Melrose Plantation in the 1960s. Toy's case never went to trial, despite verification from Hunter herself that she had not painted the works. In 1996, Toy was accused of forging Matisse and Degas paintings, selling them to an auction house in Baton Rouge. Toy, likely being the one who began forging Hunter paintings again in 1999, selling them or using them as a form of payment for doctor's bills or as collateral for a bank loan until the mid-2000s. Toy sold many of his fakes to New Orleans art and antiques dealers such as Robert Lucky Jr. Lucky internationally lied and intentionally was untruthful to his customers about the origins of 50 to 100 Hunter paintings, reselling paintings that were returned as fakes. In 2000, Robert Lucky Jr. took payment for a Hunter painting that he never gave to the customer, and was charged and arrested. Some noted Hunter collectors caught on to his scheme, such as Robert Ryan, who returned some paintings bought from Lucky, demanding a refund, Shelby Gilley and Tom Whitehead, scholars, collectors, and friends of Hunter, also figured out that the bulk of Hunter fakes were coming from Lucky, leading them to open an investigation. Whitehead had bought a total of 17 fake Clementine Hunter paintings from Lucky, spending a total of $55,000. In 2005, Tom Whitehead, Shelby Gilley, and Jack Britton hired Frank Presser, an art authentication expert, to investigate these forgeries. Presser analyzed the materials used in the paintings in question, compared those sold by Lucky, and determined that they were, in fact, inconsistent materials. The investigation uncovered paintings sold by William Toy, which were consistent with the fakes sold by Robert Buckey Jr. As Toy began selling the fakes directly to buyers in 2005. At that time, Beryl Toy was selling Hunter fakes for $3,500 a painting at a New Orleans auction house. In 2009, Federal Bureau of Investigation Special Agent Randolph Deaton assembled a team of noted art authentication experts to begin a formal investigation into the forgeries. The team included Joseph Berube of Macron Associates, a scientific analysis company, and James Martin, a forensics art expert of Orion Analytical. The group used several methods to analyze Hunter's original works to compare to the alleged forgeries, including an analysis of pigment cracks, paint age, paint style. However, one of the most important clues that a painting was a Hunter original were her fingerprints on the back of the oil painting. Hunter did not use an easel, so the backs and borders of her paintings are smudged with paint, unlike the forgeries by Toy, who used an easel to paint his fakes. In September of 2009, the FBI determined that William Toy was the one producing the forgeries and raided his home. Toy, who was accused of selling forged paintings 3 times over the course of 4 decades, pleaded guilty in federal court on June 6, 2011. The couple was charged with mail fraud and conspiracy to commit mail fraud. The price for Hunter paintings ranged between a few $1,000s to $20,000, according to Tom Whitehead. Both William and Beryl Toy were sentenced to 2 years probation and a $426,000 fine. $426,393 fine for the cost of the fakes that were sold. Robert Lucky Jr. was charged with mail fraud and pled guilty, was sentenced to 25 months in prison and a $326,893 fine. This investigation was crucial to protecting Hunter's legacy, as many of the fakes were shown in museums and private collections around the world. Additionally, very few FBI forgery cases investigate folk artists or outsider artists, and so this case helped to legitimize the value of self-taught artists. Some of these selected works and collections are Funeral Procession from 1950 at the Savannah College of Art and Design, Untitled from 1981 at the National Museum of Women in the Arts, Washington, D.C., Melrose Quilt, circa 1960, Smithsonian American Art Museum, Washington, D.C., The Wash, circa 1950s, Minneapolis Institute of Art, Minneapolis, Minnesota, The Annunciation and the Adoration of the Wise Men, 1957, Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, Picking Cotton, circa 1950, Minneapolis Institute of Art, Cotton Picking, 1948, American Folk Art Museum, New York, New York, Baptism, 1950 through 1956, the Abby Aldrich Rockefeller Folk Art Museum at Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia, Funeral, 1957, Muscarel Museum of Art in Williamsburg, Virginia, Sugarcane Syrup Making in 1979, Muscarel Museum of Art, Williamsburg, Virginia, Baptism, late 1950s, Muscarel Museum of Art, Williamsburg, Virginia, Window Shade, 1950s, National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., circa 1950s, at the Perez Art Museum in Miami, Florida. Now that, to me, wow, just spectacular. The fact that this woman did all of that, all herself, and ended up being one of the most celebrated artists ever, just amazes me. Now, there are also different perspectives about Hunter's work. There was an article in Smithsonian Magazine that's titled, "Self-Taught Artist Clementine Hunter Painted the Bold Hues of Southern Life" by Roger Kaplan, museum correspondent, in October of 2018. On view, Hunter's colorful artwork depicts work in the field, church on Sundays, and laundry on the line. She was born just 20 years after the Civil War. Her grandparents were enslaved, and after decades of working in a storied Louisiana plantation, Clementine Hunter picked up a brush and began depicting African-American life in the South, turning out thousands of paintings, first sold for less than a dollar, that are now selling for thousands. Often called the Black Grandma Moses for the simplicity of her work and her late life enthusiasm for it, the artist, who passed in 1988 at age 101, is being celebrated in an exhibition held in the Rimes Family Foundation Visual Art Gallery at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. The 13 works in Clementine Hunter, Life on Melrose Plantation, draw from 22 in the museum's collections, gifted to the museum by 3 different donors, are divided into themes that recurred in her art: religion, daily life, and the plantation landscape. Another Hunter painting, Black Jesus, hangs in the museum's permanent art collection. Talisa Fleming, the museum's curator of American art, states, "This is the largest collection of art we have by a single artist. We really wanted to do this show to highlight a woman artist and also a self-taught artist," end quote. There are certain artists who can't stop creating, and Clementine Hunter was one of these artists. Hunter was born into a Creole family at the Hidden Hill Plantation, thought to be the inspiration for Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was there, in the Cane River region of central Louisiana, where she began working in the fields while young, receiving less than a year of formal education and never learning how to read or write. Her family then moved to Melrose Plantation, south of Natchitoches, when she was 15, continuing to work, picking cotton, and harvesting pecans until the 1920s, when she became a domestic worker, cooking and doing laundry. Melrose Plantation was interesting because it was started by a mixed-race Creole, Fleming says. By the time Hunter moved there, it was run by a woman who cultivated the arts and, quote, "would have artists from all over the country come and live as artists in residence," end quote. The writers and artists who spent time there in the outbuildings she restored and brought in ranged from William Faulkner and writer Lyle Saxon to film star Margaret Sullivan, critic Alexander Wolcott, and photographer Richard Avedon. When New Orleans artist Alberta Kinsey left some brushes and discarded tubes of paint after a visit in 1939, Hunter began to dabble with them, making pictures first on window shades, then on any kind of suitable material. She painted so much that Francois Mignon, the plantation curator, brought them to a local drugstore to sell for a dollar. Hunter also illustrated Mignon's 1956 Melrose Plantation Cookbook, and, supplied with materials by Mignon, her paintings were available for viewing in the shack where she worked for 25 or 50 cents. Fleming says of Mignon, he was the one who really promoted her art. He saw her talent, and he encouraged that. He would buy her art supplies. Mignon also got her to install a series of murals that stand today on the plantation's so-called Africa House, so named because it was thought to have Congolese origins to its design, when actually it traced to the French. The works on display show life on the plantation, with work in the field, laundresses busy hanging sheets in the Louisiana sun, and everyone pausing to go to church on Sundays. She depicted life in bright colors and simple shapes, but she also imposed her own vision as well. Fleming points out, one of the things you'll see throughout her work is that the men tended to be smaller than the women. She always elevated women's work and women within her paintings, and I don't know exactly why she made the men smaller, but people say she had a lower opinion of them. Hunter's sheer productivity can be attributed to her long life. She lived to 101 and painted every day until toward the end of her life. They say she painted between 5,000 and 10,000 paintings, Fleming says. It was something she felt compelled to do. There are certain artists who can't stop creating, and she was one of those artists. Painting on the variety of materials she used, from cardboard to masonite to wood, presented a special challenge to conservators, says Xia Sun Tseng, senior conservator at the Smithsonian's Museum Conservation Institute. Not more than a painting done on a window shade that was nonetheless still used as a shade, such that years of rolling and unrolling put marks in the piece. The work then had to be flattened and retouched, but when it was hung in a new frame, the original window roller was restored as well. Sand quotes, "It's very unusual material of the window shade as canvas. I've never worked with it before." The exhibition at the popular 2-year-old National Museum of African American History and Culture is not the first museum show for Hunter, whose works hang in many museums. During her lifetime, she was the first African American artist to have a solo exhibition at what is now the New Orleans Museum of Art. But because of Jim Crow laws of the era, she couldn't attend her own exhibition. When Jimmy Carter invited her to the White House during his presidency, Hunter declined because she didn't like to travel outside of Louisiana. Clementine Hunter, Life on Melrose Plantation. This was an exhibit that went through December of 2019 at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. My goodness. I think it is so important that people get to hear stories like this, because most of the time works by artists of color are rarely spoken about in textbooks or classrooms. And it's very good to hear stories like that. I mean, there is another painter that did some really great famous works, and his name was Henry Osawa Tanner. He was born on June the 21st, 1859, and he passed on May the 25th, 1937. He was an African-American artist who spent much of his career in France. He became the first African-American painter to gain international acclaim. Tanner moved to Paris, France, in 1891 to study at the Académie Julien and gained acclaim in French artistic circles. In 1923, the French government elected Tanner Chevalier of the Legion of Honor. He studied with Thomas Eakins at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Later, he studied with Jean-Paul Lorenz and Jean-Joseph Benjamin Constant at the Académie Julien in Paris, France. Known for his paintings and drawings, some of his most notable works are The Banjo Lesson from 1893, The Resurrection of Lazarus from 1896, The Annunciation from 1898, Nicodemus Visiting Christ from 1899, Flight into Egypt from 1899. His art was in the movements of American Realism, French Academic, Impressionism, and Symbolism. He was married to Jessie Macaulay Olson from 1899 until she passed in 1925. They had one child. He won the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts Lippincott Prize in 1900, the Silver Medal at the Exposition Universelle in Paris in 1900. He was elected a member of the National Academy of Design in 1910, made an honorary Chevalier of the Order of the Legion of Honor in 1923, and some of the patrons that supported his art were Joseph Crane Hartswell, Rodman Wanamaker, and Atherton Curtis. He was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His father, Benjamin Tucker Tanner, became a bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the first independent African-American denomination in the United States. He was educated at Avery College and Western Theological Seminary in Pittsburgh and developed a literary career. In addition, he was a political activist supporting abolition of slavery. Henry Tanner's mother, Sarah Elizabeth Tanner, may have been born into slavery in Virginia. Two different stories have emerged concerning her living in freedom. In one, her father drives the family from Winchester, Virginia, to the free state of Pennsylvania in an ox cart. In the other, she escapes as a refugee to the north via the Underground Railroad. Then she met and married Benjamin Tucker Tanner. Tanner was the first of nine children, and two of his brothers, Benjamin and Horace, passed in infancy. One of his sisters, Hallie Tanner Dillon Johnson, was the first woman to be certified to practice medicine in Alabama. His parents gave him a middle name that commemorated the struggle at Osawatomie between pro- and anti-slavery partisans. The family moved from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia when Tanner was a teenager. There, his father became a friend of Frederick Douglass, sometimes supporting him, sometimes criticizing. Robert Douglass Jr., a successful African-American artist in Philadelphia, was an early neighbor of the Tanner family, and Tanner wrote that he, quote, used to pass and always stopped to look at his pictures in the window, end quote. When Tanner was about 13 years old, he saw a landscape painter working in Fairmount Park, where he was walking with his father. He decided that he wanted to be a painter. Although many white artists refused to accept an African-American apprentice in 1879, Tanner enrolled in 1879 at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia, becoming the only African-American student. His decision to attend the school came at a time when art academies increasingly concentrated on study from live models rather than plaster casts. Thomas Eakins, a professor at the Pennsylvania Academy, was one of the first American artists to promote new approaches to artistic education, including increased study from live models, discussion of anatomy in classes of both male and female students, and dissections of cadavers to teach anatomy. Eakin's progressive approach to an education had a profound effect on Tanner. The young artist was one of Eakin's favorite students. 2 decades after Tanner left the academy, Eakin's painted his portrait. At the academy, Tanner befriended artists with whom he kept in contact throughout the rest of his life, most notably Robert Henry, one of the founders of the Ashcan School. During a relatively short time at the academy, Tanner developed a thorough knowledge of anatomy and the skill to express his understanding of the weight and structure of the human figure on the canvas. Tanner's artistic studies were disrupted by illness, which was reported in November 1881 and said to have persisted into the following summer, when Tanner spent his time recovering in the Adirondack Mountains. Tanner's teachers included Thomas Eakins, American Realism Photography, Thomas Hollenden, American Realism, Benjamin Constant, Orientalist Paintings and Portraits, French Academic, and Jean-Paul Lorenz, History Painting, French Academic. Tanner painted landscapes, religious subjects, and scenes of daily life in a realistic style that echoed that of Eakins. While works like The Banjo Lesson depicted everyday scenes of African-American life, Tanner later painted religious subjects. It is likely that Tanner's father, a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, was a formative influence for him. Tanner was not limited to one specific approach to painting and drawing. His works reflected, at times, meticulous attention to detail and loose, expressive brushstrokes in others. Tanner was also interested in the effects that color could have in a painting. Warmer compositions such as The Resurrection of Lazarus from 1896 and The Annunciation from 1898 express the intensity and fire of religious moments and the elation of transcendence between the divine and humanity. Other paintings emphasize cool hues, which became a dominant in his work force, and that became so dominant in his work after the mid-1890s, a palette of indigo and turquoise, referred to as the Tanner Blues, characterizes works such as The Three Marys from 1910, Gateway from 1912, and The Arch from 1919. Works such as The Good Shepherd from 1903 and Return of the Holy Women from 1904 evoke a feeling of somber religiosity and introspection. Tanner often experimented with light in his works, which at times adds symbolic meaning. In The Annunciation, 1898, for example, the Archangel Gabriel is represented as a column of light that forms together with the shelf in the upper left corner across. Although Tanner gained confidence as an artist and began to sell his work, he faced racism working as a professional artist in Philadelphia. In his autobiography, The Story of an Artist's Life, Tanner described the burden of racism. Quote, I was extremely timid and to be made to feel that I was not wanted, although in a place where I had every right to be. Even months afterward caused me sometimes weeks of pain. Every time any one of these disagreeable incidents came into my mind, my heart sank, and I was anew, tortured by the thought of what I had endured almost as much as the incident itself. In the hope of earning enough money to travel to Europe, Tanner operated a photography studio in Atlanta during the late 1880s. The venture was unsuccessful. During this period, Danner met Bishop Joseph Crane Hartzell, a trustee of Clark College, now Clark Atlanta University. Hartzell and his wife befriended Danner, became his patrons, and recommended him for a teaching job at the college. Danner taught drawing at Clark College for a short period. Danner set out for Rome by way of Liverpool and Paris on the ship City of Chester on January 4, 1891. He found Paris to his liking and discovered the Académie Julienne, where he began his studies in France. He also joined the American Arts Student Club. Paris was a welcome escape for Danner, within French art circles race mattered little. Danner discovered the Paris Salon and set a goal to get his work accepted. On a return visit to the United States in 1893, Danner presented The American Negro in Art, an essay at the World's Congress on Africa in Chicago, and painted The Banjo Lesson, one of his most recognized works that began as a series of sketches of African-American people living in Appalachia. The painting shows an elderly African-American man teaching a young little guy, assumed to be his grandson, how to play the banjo. The image of an African-American man playing the banjo appears throughout American art of the late 19th century. And that's what I mean when I say you got to keep going, you got to keep persevering. That man did so much, regardless of the circumstances around his life. And he kept on. It is said that his life in Paris had little returns home, then he spent the rest of his life there. But he acclimated quickly to Parisian life and became friends with Atherton Curtis. He was part of a company of artists in Mount Kisco, New York, for 6 months in 1902 at the behest of Curtis, and returned the following winter. In Paris, Danner continued his studies under renowned artists such as Jean-Joseph Benjamin Constant and Jean-Paul Lorenz. With their guidance, he began to establish a reputation in France. He settled at the Estepals Art Colony in Normandy. There, he was introduced to many artists whose works would affect his approach to art. At the Louvre, he encountered and studied the works of Gustave Courbet, Jean-Baptiste Chardin, and Louis Lanin. These artists had painted scenes of ordinary people in their environment, and the influence in Danner's work is noticeable. That of Courbet's The Stone Breakers in 1850, which was destroyed, can be seen in the similarities in Danner's The Young Sabbath Maker in 1895. Both paintings explore the themes of apprenticeship and manual labor. It's like I always say, explore, connect, create, and inspire.
You have been listening to The African American Experience, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. This program is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. I'm Tina E. Gaffney. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Low vision and blind persons in the Worcester area are fortunate to have a support group sponsored by the Massachusetts Association for the Blind in Worcester. The group meets monthly at the Worcester Senior Center and provides information and resources to assist with daily living, assistive technology, transportation, and friendship. For more information, please call Marion at 508-754-0672. Again, that telephone number is 508-754-0672.